Hello and welcome back. I'm Naomi Guy and you're listening to Wawanoan Date These Guys podcast. I just would like to formally introduce myself in case you're new here. I usually run this podcast with my brother, but he is sadly out of town. We usually talk about sex, dating, relationships, and today we are talking about something that is dear to my heart because I've been on my own birth control journey recently, and that is the book This Is Your Brain on Birth Control by Sarah E. Hill. Sorry, Dr. Sarah E. Hill. I want to give her the proper title that she deserves, that she earned. One of the main reasons that I'm talking about this and we're not having a formal discussion between Joel and I like we normally do during book topics, book club episodes, is because a lot of this episode is going to be me just listing scientific facts, things that you don't normally learn when you go to the doctor, things that are not brought up unless you look very specifically on the internet and ask very specific questions. A lot of this I didn't know until I read this book. I would like to give full credit to Giselle Lee, who passed on this book to me after she had read it. I, like I mentioned, am on my own birth control journey right now. To be a little blunt about the topic, I started on birth control when I was about 16, and that was purely for preventative measures. I was sexually active, and, you know, nobody wants a teen that's pregnant. So my mom was like, okay, we're going to the gynecologist. We're going to get you on birth control. And from there, I went through about 6 birth control types. I started on the Nexplanon, you know, form of birth control. It's basically just something that you put in your arm so you don't have to worry about a daily contraceptive. And then that didn't work. I was on that for about 6 months, and I was not the best emotionally. Mentally, I was very down in the dumps. My doctor had told me to, you know, give it more time, really let my this birth control method set in. And I was like, no, this just isn't working for me. I don't like how I feel. I don't like how my emotions are consistently on a roller coaster. So we moved on to different forms of birth control. I have yet to try an IUD. That might be something that I might start, like that I might be interested in later. But I then went through a consistent, you know, I went through a bunch of different forms of birth control because I didn't find what was right for me. And I was consistently, I don't want to say gaslit. I feel like that might be too strong of a term, but I wasn't listened to when I went to the doctor. So I would like to say that I liked this book because you can really figure out your own body. It's not taught to you in your high school biology class. It sure as hell is not taught to you, you know, in a college level biology class. Trust me, I've taken those. I've taken a lot of them. So I would like to say, unless you are specializing in fertility, you're specializing in, you know, obstetrics or gynecology, you're a nurse, you're studying to be a doctor, you're not given this information. So that's my little spiel on that. Currently, right now, I am looking for a firm form of birth control that, you know, is a lot better for me than the contraceptive that I'm using right now. I'm using a low estrogen form of birth control that, you know, it does the job. It makes me feel okay. But at the same time, it's a form of birth control that I would not like to continue to use because when looking at the side effects, if I eat one too many grapefruits, for instance, I could be at more risk of a blood clot and so on and so forth. So this is something that I've been talking about for a while with my partner. But of course, we're both not in a position to, you know, take that risk, take that plunge of, you know, having that possible risk of, you know, conceiving a child. So that's something that I am hyper aware of. I'm also hyper aware that this is a form of birth control that keeps me regular. And I I suffer from really, really bad menstrual cramps to the point where I have lost time at work. I've lost time at school. And I would just like to say that menstrual symptoms, I didn't know this until reading this book, cause more than 100 million lost work hours annually for US women. And I don't know how accurate that statistic is, but the fact that that is a statistic that is taken, it's probably a lot more, is insane to me. So I would like to do a brief intro about the author. Today, like I mentioned, I have a lot of scientific facts. You know, that's kind of my bread and butter. If you didn't know, I am a public health major at the University of San Diego. I'm getting my master's degree. And so I love statistics. I love reading scientific papers. I would love to, you know, like I've helped publish a few, but I would love to have like my name on one someday. But what I would like to say is that this is just packed full of information. If you are not one to, you know, like that kind of thing, that's totally fine. It's understandable. I would say that it's, you know, it's an hour of your life and it's great information. I have found this book. If you're more of an audiobook person and you don't just want, you know, the amount of information that I have, but you want to dive deeper in, I would definitely recommend this book. Again, it's called This Is Your Brain on Birth Control: The Surprising Science of Women, Hormones, and the Law of Unintended Consequences by Sarah E. Hill, Dr. Sarah E. Hill. So I did recently just find out that Spotify does free audiobooks for premium members. This is not sponsored. I just really, I use Spotify, so that's why I'm telling you. I don't know about Apple Music or others, but if you can pick up a book, this book is great. I have the hardcover copy. Again, this was given to me by Giselle, who was one of our former guests on the podcast. So let's get right into this. Brief introduction about the author. She spent more than a decade of her life on the pill, and she's better off knowing more about it, obviously, because she was on it for so long. During that time, I was able to graduate summa cum laude from college and go on to get my PhD from one of the most competitive psychology programs in the country. So I would like to say that contraceptive is great. Contraceptive is a great way to make sure that you can, as a person with a uterus, move forward in your career, move forward, you know, and plan on your own time when you're going to be conceiving a child. So I am a full proponent of it. Another great book that I read was I think it's called A Half the Sky. And I'll put more information in the description of this episode. But I really enjoyed that book because the major point of that book was talking about women all around the world and girls all around the world and talking about how important having your own timeline for children is, because the vast majority of women in third world countries don't have access to contraceptives, obviously. And so they are more likely to quit school and have children if they don't have access to contraceptives. So that would be a great book. Again, I'll put that link in the description of this episode. Like fully, vividly, awesomely human alive, she's describing how she felt after she got off birth control. This didn't happen all at once. I didn't realize that any of these changes were happening until after they happened. I just one day realized that I felt awake from an almost 10-year nap I didn't know I was taking. Being on the pill seems to influence the type of men and women you're getting involved with, their satisfaction of their partners, and even the likelihood they have for divorce. Women on birth control pills, unlike every other healthy human being on earth, are missing a key factor of their stress response. So this is just the introduction to the book, and that just hooked me in. I have found that when I'm not on birth control, I have a larger stress response. So I think it's really funny because my partner told me that I am a very even keeled person, and it's scary to think about the fact that I don't know what I'm like when I'm not on birth control. So it's scary in the sense that I don't think that he knows what I'm like also. And I've been on the same birth control our entire relationship. So I think that that's really interesting to hear that your stress response is not the same and it's more suppressed than it would be if it wasn't, if you weren't on birth control. The three main points that she's going to be, or sorry, not the three main points, but the points that she will be covering in this book are as follows. Although many of us think of hormones as something that happened to us that aren't quite right, you are your hormones. They help to form your very identity, the beliefs that you have about yourself and your behaviors. So going on and off the pill can change your very sense of who you are. It can prompt a change in identity, one that that's seemingly common, but that scientists haven't fully explored yet. The pill changes the brain. Brain scans of women who are on the pill show structural and functional differences when compared to those women who are off the pill. Women on birth control pills don't have the cortisol spike in response to stress that every other healthy human does. Researchers have been regularly documenting this effect since the 1990s, and it's shocking. As we'll discuss, cortisol plays an instrumental role in telling our body that something meaningful is going on, and not just bad stuff. It tells us when something exciting is going on, too. Being on the pill might influence who women choose to date and or who they mate with, and may have a meaningful impact on their relationship satisfaction and the likelihood that their relationships will survive. The pill may have important implications for women's social mobility, men's achievement motivation, marriage patterns, economic growth, and the divorce rate. Data shows that women's sexual standards and men's achievement levels operate in lockstep, meaning that the pill might have side effects on other people's behavior. So those are just the topics that we're going to be going over throughout this series of this book that I'm going to be essentially summarizing. This book is focused exclusively on experiences of heterosexual cisgender women because they are typically the people who go on the birth control pill. Although some lesbian women and also as well as transgender women and men go on the pill for reasons other than pregnancy prevention, research hasn't quite caught up yet. So that's just a general PSA from the author, Sarah. I would like to also do my own PSA. Kind of mentioned this towards the beginning of the episode, but I think it's dumb that I had to read this book to find out things about my own body that doctors should have informed me of. I recently just found out that no research has been really done into why the that women that are pregnant get morning sickness. And it was just recently found out within the last year or so that it is a protein that the fetus secretes. And I think that's dumb. Like, I think it's so dumb that there's not enough information being, you know, researched about women and, you know, their bodies and how they bring life into the world. I'm not going to go into the long-winded speech about how the medical system should have been better and that we need better policy and blah, 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 but I will say this. You can only trust yourself to learn this information from good sources because our doctor sure as hell won't educate you about your own body unless you come in and ask all the right questions. Read this book. We all need to know more about ourselves, and in some cases, for some of those listeners today, we will all need to know more about the female body. Or just people with uteruses. Let's be all-inclusive. Part one, let's talk about biology. As women, we have inherited from our successful female ancestors traits that allowed them generation after generation and without pause to make good decisions about everything ranging from whether to approach a snake or to have a clandestine love affair with a hot guy from a neighboring tribe. Traits that promote successful survival and reproduction get passed down from one generation to the next. Traits that don't promote survival and reproduction don't. It's that simple. This process of inheritance is called natural selection. So that's pretty much taught in every school. I hope that that was taught to you. I hope you had, you know, that basic information of biology. But if you didn't, I think it's always an interesting fact that you are the culmination of generations and generations of people coming together and conceiving a child. So the way that you look, I think that's just a beautiful way to think about it. The way that you look is generations of people coming together, conceiving children, and passing on those genes to the next generation. In the eyes of evolutionary biology, this is something that's defined by the size of your gametes, aka your sex cells. If you have limited supply of large, calorically expensive eggs, you are a female, and we have our sex cells called eggs. If you have unlimited supply of small, metabolically inexpensive gametes, you are a male, and we can call these sex cells sperm. For instance, being the sex with a larger, more expensive sex cell means that the women, before they even met the future fathers of their children, have already invested more in any babies than that they may have than in their future baby daddies to be have. And in humans and many other species, this investment asymmetry only grows larger once an egg gets fertilized. So I would just like to talk about the fact that women are born with a certain number of eggs in their body. And as soon as you start menstruating, you start to get rid of those eggs one by one. So I think that that's not really talked about a lot. You kind of have this biological clock that's talked about a lot in the media, like you have to, you know, start having children by the age of 30, so on and so forth. But that's not really talked about, that we only have a certain amount of eggs. And once they get going, there's no really stopping them once they're gone. Women had to lactate to feed their infants, and lactation is also pretty costly. In addition to requiring women to secure an additional 600 or so calories each day to offset the metabolic expense of milk production, it is also time-consuming and would have made things like food acquisition difficult for ancestral women. Women's minimal level of investment in reproduction is much greater than men's. Most women are less sexually opportunistic than men. Hundreds of studies have now found this to be true. For example, in one of the most talked about experiments of its kind, researchers had attractive male and female actors take turns standing in a quad on a college campus in Florida. They were then instructed by the researchers to approach random members of the opposite sex and say in a casual tone, "I've been noticing you around campus. I find you very attractive." The experimenter would then follow this with one of three requests, randomly assigned across encounters. Would you go out with me tonight? Would you come over to my apartment tonight? Or the very non-subtle, would you go to bed with me tonight? 50% of both men and women agreed to the date. After that, though, things differed pretty dramatically depending on whether the request was being made to someone who had a male or female brain. For women, fewer than 10% agreed to go back to the man's apartment, and none of the women agreed to sex, not one. At this point, you might be thinking to yourself, of course no one said yes to sex. Why would they do that? Only a total lunatic would request sex from a stranger. So, of course, no one would say yes to such a bizarre sexual invitation. Except for 80% of men did. Bizarre, not bizarre, men weren't about to look a sex-bearing gift horse in the mouth. Most men are more sexually opportunistic than most women because sex has historically been very costly for women and far less costly for men. In fact, for men, this has come with the possibility of being able to transmit genes into the next generation without too many follow-up costs. Being a woman means that sex is costly, and our psychology reflects those costs. Our psychology has been shaped by a myriad of female-specific adaptive challenges that come along with being the sex who is obligated to invest more. Now, before we break into a hymn of the oppressed, it's worth noting that the number of unique adaptive challenges also come along with being male. Take, for example, the issue of paternity uncertainty. Women, being the internal gestators of offspring that they are, always know that any child they have is theirs, like theirs, theirs. This means that over the span of evolutionary time, women would have always benefited from investing heavily in their children. This is why we invest so heavily in our children, even if they show no overt indicators of being one of our relatives. For men, it's a little more complicated. Since they aren't the ones who gestate babies, they can't know for certain that any children they have is theirs. This poses an adaptive challenge to them that women don't have to confront when making choices about parental investment. For example, in one study, researchers had external judges evaluate the facial resemblance of children to each of their parents. They also had the parents rate their perceived a similarity to their children and report their psychological and emotional closeness to their children. What we found was that mothers' facial resemblance to their children did not predict their emotional closeness to their children at all. For the dads, it mattered a lot. Men who report feeling the most emotional closeness with their children tend to resemble their children more than those who report low emotional closeness to their children. Several studies have now demonstrated that men's parenting psychology is highly sensitive to cues bearing to the likelihood that their children is genetically related to them. Women's parenting psychology, on the other hand, is not. Men and women have each confronted some survival and reproductive challenges that are unique to their biological sex, and their brains are different from one another as a result. So I found that super interesting because the amount of people, like, I literally read the statistic and it freaking shocked me. The statistic that for men who report feeling highly certain about being the biological fathers of their children is somewhere only between 2-4%. That literally blew my mind. Because I understand that we have a little bit more of a casual, sexual sort of culture right now. But at the same time, it's very interesting to me that it's only between 2-4% of men believe that their children are their own. And also the fact that the more alike that you look to your child as a man, the more close you are to your child is so fascinating to me. And I don't know if that's, you know, an issue of, like, if that's a evolutionary issue or if that's just something that, you know, just happens. That's a psychology thing. That was just interesting to me. So let's move on to periods. Your period is the shedding of the endometrial lining that your body builds up each month in preparation for pregnancy. The endometrium is where the fertilized egg implants itself. When no egg is fertilized, the lining of the endometrium is broken and, it's broken down and exits the body in a monthly nuance that is having your period. So I didn't know this, but we are one of a few mammals that actually menstruate. And you might ask yourself, why do we have a period? A mother and a fertilized egg don't have completely overlapping interests when it comes to implantation. Although women have 50% of their genes in common with any embryo that's inside their bodies, they have 100% of their genes in common with themselves. This last part might seem like one of the stupidest things you've ever heard, but it's actually really profound. Mothers, because they are twice as related to themselves as they are to any related fertilized eggs that tries to implant, don't always see eye to eye with that fertilized egg about whether she or he is worth the requisite 9-month investment that follows implantation. Given the substantial time and resource investment involved in pregnancy, mothers should be willing to tie up their reproductive resources in developing a fertilized egg that doesn't have a good chance in surviving into adulthood. Women's bodies should therefore be discriminating about which fertilized egg they invest in and which they do not. Now, this sort of choiciness is obviously not an ideal situation for the fertilized egg. In the eyes of the fertilized egg, it should be granted the opportunity to try to make it in the world, regardless of whether survival might be a long shot. After all, this is a once chance at life. And we are programmed for survival. Because of this, a fertilized egg should be willing to give up without a fight, only if the cost to the mom would be so great that it would make her significantly less able to reproduce in the future. Bearing such extreme cases, though, the fertilized egg should try pretty much any trick that it might have up its sleeve to take up residence in the mom's uterus and tap into her bloodstream so that it can begin to grow. Although many of us think of the endometrial lining as being this warm, snuggly blanket that lovingly embraces a fertilized egg, that's totally not how it works at all. The endometrium is actually a perilous testing ground for fertilized eggs, and it prevents rather than encourages implantation. The cells of the human endometrium create a cell-packed fortress-like wall on the inside of the uterus that the fertilized egg must burrow through if it hopes to implant and find a blood source to provide it with the energy it needs to grow. And rather than shepherding the egg through the egg through the implantation process, its densely packed cells make it more challenging for the fertilized egg to tap into mom's blood supply there than almost anywhere else in the body. How do we know that? Well, scientists have tried to implant mouse embryos in a bunch of different locations on the body, expecting them to wither away and die since they are deprived of endometrial lining to nourish and sustain them. Much to their surprise, they found that it's actually the opposite. Not only do these embryos not die, they flourish. These little cells mercilessly burrow their ways through the tissue where they were implanted, destroying everything in their wake as they rummaged around for arteries to tap into to fuel their continued growth and expansion. The endometrium is actually one of the hardest places to grow an embryo, since the environment is downright inhospitable to newly fertilized eggs. Why is this? Now, there is a good evolutionary reason for this. First off, this challenging environment provides a first test of viability for the fertilized egg. If the fertilized egg doesn't have the moxie required to burrow its way through the fortress, it might not have what it takes to survive in the real world. Those that aren't able to make this first round of cuts don't implant, and the mom never even knows that there was a fertilized egg there to begin with. Mom sheds her endometrium so that this likely unviable fertilized egg doesn't try to stick around and implant itself without having first gained mom's seal of approval. Approximately 32% of fertilized eggs are believed to meet this fate. For those that manage to burrow their way through this inhospitable landscape, a round of screening occurs based on the amount of human chorionic gonadotropin, or HCG. I'm so sorry, I just completely butchered that. The hormone HCG is released by an implanted embryo to prevent the mom's body from triggering the biological cascade that initiates menstruation. Healthier embryos produce more HCG, and less healthy embryos produce less HCG. So if an embryo isn't producing enough HCG to pass mom's standards for investment, mom's body will cut her losses by triggering the biological cascade that causes the shedding of the endometrial lining, embryo and all. An additional 24% of fertilized eggs are believed to meet this fate. The tissue of the endometrium protects the mom from having her circulatory system tapped into by the embryos that she hasn't yet decided to accept. And with around half the fertilized eggs not making the cut before most women even know they are pregnant, this is a mechanism that gets put to use more frequently than you might guess. So that's a lot of information, but I find that interesting because for me, I am a huge fan of whales, and this is going to sound really weird, but whales have trap doors, I guess you could call them, in their vagina. And so if they don't want to be pregnant, they can just use those trap doors to spontaneously abort their child or their, you know, fetus. And essentially, this is not exactly what your body's doing, but it's interesting to hear that you could be pregnant. I'm using that term a lot more loosely than I should. A lot more of the time than you think that you are. So it's interesting to me that the body has such a system. But again, this is just going back to basic evolution. Like, it's survival of the fittest. If the baby or the fetus or the whatever you want to call it, the cells can't attach and they aren't viable straight off the bat, that's a great way to get rid of them. So we talked about periods. Let's talk about hormones. Hormones are signaling molecules that are synthesized in one part of your body, and they're released into the bloodstream and picked up by any cells in the body that have matching hormone receptors. The primary job of hormones is to keep all of our bodily systems on the same page about what the body should be doing at any given moment in time. Here's a non-exhaustive list of some of the activities our hormones have been coordinating lately. Digestion, metabolism, sensory perception, sleep, respiration, lactation, stress, growth, development, sex, childbirth, menstrual cycle, mood, and anything that we've done in the bathroom with the door closed. For women, the predominant sex hormones are estrogen and progesterone. So that is what's commonly found in birth control, is different levels of estrogen and progesterone. And the one that tends to get most of the attention is estrogen. And this is for a good reason. Estrogen is the hormone that's responsible for most of the things that we think about when we think about what makes women women. For example, it's responsible for the development and maintenance of things like breasts and hourglass body shapes, as well as the development and regulation of the reproductive system. Estrogen is also instrumental in making our body ready for the possibility of pregnancy each month, as well as motivating behaviors that make pregnancy possible. For now, it's worth noting that women generally feel a little more flirtatious and spunky during the estrogen-dominant half of their cycle than they do later on. The other of women's major sex hormones is progesterone. Whereas estrogen is the flirtatious sex kitten of women's hormones, progesterone is more like the mom genes, earth mother hormone. This hormone helps coordinate all the nesting-related activities that help prepare the body for the possibility of embryo implantation, and helps close off the cervix to any germs or sperm that might try to make their way into in after conception has occurred. When progesterone is on the scene, women tend to feel hungrier and sleepier and more relaxed than they do at other points in the cycle. It makes women feel like doing the kinds of things that help keep their body ready for the possibility of needing to grow another human being in the not-too-distant future. Your sex hormones influence how you think, how you feel, how you see the world, how you behave, how you look, how you smell, the excitability of your brain cells, what your immune system does, how much you eat, and just about everything else you can possibly imagine. Broadly speaking, women's cycles can be broken into two halves. So now we are talking about our cycles and more about our periods. So we talked about what a period is, our hormones, and now we're going into the cycle and the women's cycle. So I have been learning a lot more about cycles recently and the four different parts of the cycle and how each week, depending on how long your cycle is, I'm saying week roughly, because cycles can be 28 days up to 32 days. So it's interesting to me that women's cycles are that long, but men's cycles are just our 24-hour period. What I would do to have a 24-hour cycle, let me tell you. Broadly speaking, women's cycles have been broken into two halves, each of which is dedicated to accomplishing one of the two tasks required of women's bodies for reproduction to occur. These two tasks are conception, coordinated by estrogen, which is dominant during the first half of the cycle, and implantation, coordinated by progesterone, which is dominant during the second half of the cycle. The conception phase of your cycle, which is called the follicular phase, starts day one, when you get your period and continues until the egg is released from at ovulation, which usually occurs somewhere around day 10 to 14-ish. Estrogen increases during this phase, peaking just prior to ovulation with the release of a mature egg. The implantation phase of the cycle, which is called the luteal phase, starts after ovulation when a temporary endocrine structure called the corpus luteum is formed in the newly vacated egg follicle. Its job is to produce progesterone, which rises steadily across the second half of the cycle, generally peaking somewhere between the days of 20 to 22. Now, the ovulatory cycle, in many respects, the perfect way to illustrate the degree to which changing our hormones changes what we think, feel, and do based on the activities each hormone is charged with coordinating. Because estrogen is in charge of coordinating the activities related to conception, we should find that during the time in the cycle when it is the dominant hormone, women are versions of themselves that help facilitate the activity. And because progesterone is in charge of coordinating the activities related to implantation and pregnancy, we should find that during that time in the cycle when it's the dominant hormone, women are versions of themselves that help facilitate these activities. One of the four things that the pill does to keep women non-pregnant is prevent the hormonal cascade that promotes ovulation. However, in addition to preventing the maturation and release of an egg, it also prevents women's bodies and brains from doing all the other things that they're supposed to do at the time in the cycle when the egg is ready to be released. So let's talk about the effects of cycle phase on women's desire for sex. Since reproduction requires getting sperm within proximity of an egg, it means that it is required women to have some sex. More specifically, it is required women to have sex at the time in the cycle when it is likely to result in sperm being present at the same time as a released egg. And although the egg is being impatient, Sperm can stay alive for 5-ish days in the woman's reproductive tract in a pursuit of an egg. This means that if conception is going to occur, women need to have sex within 24 hours of ovulation or up to 5-ish days beforehand. Given that estrogen is charged with coordinating the body's conception-promoting behaviors, we should find that estrogen surge that occurs near ovulation leads women to want more sex than they do at times in the cycle when conception is not possible, which it turns out they do. Numerous studies have now shown that the pre-ovulatory phase in the cycle, the 5 or so days prior to the ovulation and on the day of ovulation itself, is marked by an increase in sexual desire, changes that are driven by increasing levels of estrogen during this time. For example, in one study, researchers found that changing levels of estrogen were positively related to women's sexual desire across the cycle, whereas women's changing levels of estrogen had the opposite effect. These hormonally mediated patterns in sexual desire are also found in lesbian women and are also found in non-human primates. So, let's talk about the research backing this. In one study of 68 partnered women, researchers collected daily urine samples across multiple cycles to precisely pinpoint the time of ovulation. The women were also required to keep daily diaries about their sexual behavior. The result of this study found that there is a striking jump in women's sexual behavior near the fertile window in the cycle, followed by a sustained drop of cyclical fertility as for cyclical fertility declined during the second half of the cycle when progesterone is high. Numerous other studies have found similar results and have supported the idea that these effects emerge from changes in women's sexual motivation at the time when conception is possible. This makes good evolutionary sense. In addition to facilitating pair bonding by promoting emotional closeness, sex is a good way to get genes from one generation to the next. It makes good old-fashioned evolutionary sense that our hormones promote sexual behavior during times when conception is possible. Consistent with the idea, researchers found that women feel sexier and are more open to new experiences and put more effort into their appearance at high fertility than at low fertility across the cycle. Women at high fertility also wear more makeup, wear sexier clothes, buy sexier clothes, and wear more red, which is a color known to make women appear particularly attractive and desirable to men. This research suggests that estrogen plays a fundamental role in motivating women's appearance enhancement efforts. With these efforts peaking along with estrogen in the cycle, estrogen, which it coordinates bodily activities that promote conception, makes women feel sexier and more interested in doing things to maximize their attractiveness to men. It also increases their interest in sex and makes them more likely to actually have it. A woman can also increase her evolutionary fitness by choosing partners that have potential to offer indirect fitness benefits. These are the genetic benefits that a woman can give her child simply by choosing the mate with a partner that has the type of genes that promote healthy, surviving offspring. And, as luck would have it, the men who are most likely to give these benefits are the men who are most attractive to anyway. That's right. Having your head turned at the sight of Mr. Square Jaw with awesome shoulders, who you might see at the gym, actually serves a bona fide evolutionary function. It's a means of helping you get good genes for your future offspring. And you thought you were just being shallow. I know that it sounds too good to be true, but it's not. You see, there's actually nothing inherently sexy and desirable about sexy and desirable men. You just find them to be this way because your brain finds the qualities that they possess rewarding. Tall, symmetrical men with deep voices, ambition, and swagger cause our brain to produce beautiful fireworks that make us feel good about these qualities, provide cues to think that health and developmental stability, which creates more successful pregnancy and healthier children. And that's all that is needed to happen for a mate preference to evolve. Your brain has inherited the tendency to find sexy men sexy because our female ancestors, by exhibiting their same preference, were able to pass down genes to enough surviving children to get you where you are today. Sexiness is in the brain of the beholder, and the brain becomes particularly attuned to these qualities when estrogen is high. So here's another great study that I really enjoyed reading about in this book. So like I mentioned earlier on, this during high levels of estrogen in your body, you are more likely to dress sexy, have a more confident like aura about you, and so on and so forth. So a strip club actually provides an interesting opportunity to see whether a woman's fertility status influences their sexiness to men in a quantifiable, non-reactive way. This is because men, without prompting by a researcher, naturally quantify their interest in different dancers by leaving a tip. Men tend to give higher tips to the dancers they prefer, allowing the researchers to test whether men find women more desirable at high fertility by looking at how much tip money the dancers can earn across their cycles. Think what you will about strip clubs and men who visit them, but this is a pretty ingenious method of data collection. To test their hypothesis, the researchers had the dancers, half of whom were naturally cycling and half of whom were on the pill, which prevents ovulation by keeping hormones relatively stable across the cycle, record their tip earnings over the course of 2 months. The women also reported when their periods began and ended, so the researchers could calculate where they were in their cycles. The results of this study found that the dancers earned around $70 per hour when they were near ovulation. They earned around $35 per hour during their periods, and they earned about $50 per hour at other times when fertility was waxing and waning, while like those observed by the natural cycling women. In one study, researchers had 200 men. This is a different study. Sorry, had to say. In one study, researchers had 200 men evaluate the attractiveness of women's bodies, body movements from video clips of their silhouettes dancing and walking at high and low fertility. Men found the movements made by women at high fertility to be significantly more attractive than those with low fertility. Researchers also discovered that men and women find photographs of women's faces that have been taken in the fertile phase of women's cycles as being more attractive than photos of the same woman's face taken at a non-fertile phase. Similar effects are found in vocal recordings, which men find more attractive at high fertility than low. Other researchers find that estrogen, in addition to being associated with higher perceived attractiveness, also changes how feminine and healthy women appear. Women are perceived as being healthier and more feminine at the fertile phase of the cycle than at the non-fertile phase. And still, other researchers find that women's faces and voices are considered less attractive at the points in the cycle that are dominated by progesterone than those dominated by estrogen. So I just find that very intriguing to me, because you see all those pictures of those beautiful women on, the front of magazines and stuff. You see, great pictures of people on social media, and you have to wonder, does that attribute to the attractiveness of the person in the picture? Obviously, there's a lot of airbrushing that goes on. There's a lot of Photoshop that goes on social media. But honestly, that's something that I'm now hyper aware of. When I'm, looking through pictures of women or on social media, or looking at pictures, in the grocery line of, People magazine or whatever. Just that, the fact that plays such a big role is really interesting to me. Several studies have found that women's natural body scents collected at high fertility are rated by men as being more desirable and pleasant than scents collected at low fertility. This relationship is not observed for women on the pill that lack a cyclical estrogen surge. Others find that the scent of women's vaginal secretions are also perceived as being less intense and more pleasant at high fertility compared to those at low fertility, and that men's testosterone increases after smelling t-shirts worn by women near ovulation, but decreases when they smell t-shirts worn during the luteal phase. So I didn't know this, but apparently the vulva contains as many scent-producing glands as the armpits do. And given their geographic location on the body, the scent produced in this region seems like reasonable informants of a woman's fertility status. So another study had women tape a cotton pad in their armpits overnight and wear an unscented panty liner for 8 hours. They did this once at high fertility and once at low fertility. The women then turned in their samples, which the researchers simply stuck in the medicinal chamber of a nebulizer, and then had men breathe in the scents of women. The air they inhaled was either suffused with odors provided by a woman's female donor or odors from clean, unused cotton pad. The results of this study found that the sample odors provided by women in the fertile phase of this of their cycles increased men's level of sex and stress hormones, with the strongest effect being found by the scents from the vulva. These men also reported being more interested in sex after smelling the high fertility scents than after breathing in the control of or low fertility scents. Similarly, other researchers have found that smelling t-shirts worn by women at high fertility prompted men to spontaneously start thinking about sex, and that men interacting with an attractive female researcher at high fertility engaged in more behavioral mimicry, something that we do when we like someone and want them to like us back, than they do when interacting with her when she was at low fertility. So that is the end of part one of This Is Your Brain on Birth Control. I found that extremely interesting. I hope you did too. I do like to mention that we have a Patreon at datetheseguys.com. You can find our Patreon. We understand that the economy sucks right now, and it's totally okay if you don't want to donate money to us, but we do like to mention that if you could, we would love for you to go give us a rate, maybe leave us a comment or something on one of our many streaming platforms. So, we appreciate you all very much for supporting our podcast. I hope you found this as interesting as I did, and we'll see you back here next week.
Many thanks for the use of our theme music, which is the song Drop by Ketsa. You can find more of their music online at ketsa.uk. You can also find Date These Guys online on Twitter and Instagram at Date These Guys or visit datetheseguys.org. If you have questions for the podcast or want to be a wealthy sugar parent, send an email to datetheseguys@gmail.com. If you're looking to make an impact in the world, this show strongly recommends Planned Parenthood, a nonprofit organization that provides reproductive health care in the United States. Planned Parenthood provides birth control, long-acting reversible contraceptive implants, clinical breast examinations, pregnancy screenings, prenatal care, testing and treatment for sexually transmitted infections, and abortions. They also do great work for those who are lower income. Four-fifths of their clients are at or below 50% of the federal poverty line. Both Joel and Naomi are monthly donors to Planned Parenthood. We hope you will be too.